Welcome to Season 4 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication. Proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you're looking for a board game table, bag, playmat, or great board games, check them out at letsallplay.com.
Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 84, Mischief. Today we are joined by Glenn Cotter, the designer of Mischief, previously called Fickle. So thanks for joining.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm excited to talk about this game because I don't have a lot of people on that sign a game and then it goes through a second round with a new name, new art, and all that good stuff. But before we get into that, how did you get into being a game designer?
Okay, into game designer. I mean, a lot of people trace it back to like, you know, okay, I played a lot of Magic. That I think a lot of us have that shared story. But for me, I mean, that's true for me, but I trace it back a lot to game lunches at work. We would, you know, keep saying I do creative work professionally and sometimes there's crazy long hours, but every once a week we would get into like lunchtime gaming. And again, that helps you keep sane when you have long hours. Also doing creative work, I decided that every year I would do one creative project totally unrelated to work every year. And what, like 8 years ago now, I said, hey, I like games. We do this game lunch. I think I'll make a board game. I started doing that. And then I found the community of game designers in the Bay Area. And it was awesome. I just wanted to make more games to hang out with these people, you know? I say this to a lot of people when they first come to a meetup. We find the community and it's like, oh, they're creative, generally intelligent, and passionate about fun. I just want to hang out with them. So that's how I kind of came into the community. And now I'm into helping organize meetups and all that.
I ended up taking over a meetup back when I used to live in Chicago for a very similar reason. I just got obsessed with game design, and at least for me, having a girl be kind of in charge helped bring more girls into it, which was really awesome.
That's great. I actually met you online doing the virtual meetups during the pandemic when you were doing that as well.
Oh man, we were one of the first ones to go online, and since then it's died out. And sadly, I think the local one that I used to be in charge of also died out because I no longer live in the Chicago area. But oh, well, I mean, they have other ones in the different suburbs. Thankfully, Chicago is still a pretty good hub for designers. But I actually didn't realize the Bay Area had a lot of designers. That's cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can tell you about that later.
All right. That's true. Because we are talking about technically the same game, but also kind of like a new version of it. Let's focus on how to play the current version of Mischief. And then we'll kind of go back and you can talk about the differences between it and Fickle.
So in Mischief, you are trying to build the strongest alliance from mischievous tribes of fairies using trickery and sabotage. Every round, you will play a fairy from one of six tribes to your alliance, and each tribe has a unique power that enables you to improve your alliance or thwart your opponents. It's going to be from Smirk and Dagger, plays 1 to 6 players in under 20 minutes. So I kind of categorize it as a push-your-luck drafting anti-set collection game, if that makes any sense.
No, I mean, I like the description.
And then, so do you want to just go over like the kind of the rules of play or overall?
Yeah, sure. So if you're playing the game, explain how's the setup, like what are you doing on your turn? What does it mean to be an anti-set collection?
Okay, so Mischief plays in 5 rounds. Each round has 2 parts of play, the trickery phase and the sabotage phase. So trickery is a simultaneous play phase where you stack 3 cards in any order you choose for an opponent while an opponent does the same for you. Then everyone drafts a single fairy, kind of push your luck style, where you look at the top card and decide, is this the fairy I want to choose for this round? If you want to look at the next card in the stack, you must first discard the current one. So you go on and you're like, okay, you got to think about, did my opponent bury a better card in the stack, or are they trying to trick me to taking something I really don't want? Because if you get to that third card, you're going to have to play it, even if the effect is damaging to your alliance. Okay, that's the trickery phase. That's all simultaneous. Then in the sabotage phase is when you actually play those cards. And you know, it's simply, you're going to, this is where you have to do it in sequence. You put it into your alliance and resolve its power. Now, different tribes have different powers where they add, remove, exchange fairies, or have special scoring abilities. Mischief comes with 13 different tribes. Each is a deck. Each has its own unique ability, but every game only uses 6 of them. So you can kind of mix and match, and the strategy can change from tactical high chaos to really like thoughtful, unforgiving choices, depending on which combination of 6 tribes you play with. The game ends after 5 rounds of play. Your alliance is scored based on the fairies in it. Generally, you're trying to get diversity, and that's kind of like the anti-set collection. You want high-ranking members of each tribe, and the ranks value from 1 to 5. But if you have too many of the same, that tribe's contribution can be either neutralized or even count against you. So the best case scenario is you either have 1 of each.
Okay. Yeah, I actually just played Skull, and I was teaching it to my friends that are just not good at bluffing games. So it did not work, but I always enjoy the like, all right, do we dig deeper? Do we push our luck or not? And that's cool that you use that in this like very, sounds pretty simple, fairy game.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. Like even if you don't, this is a nice bluffing game when you don't know how to bluff. I've even had people look at me like, I don't know how to order them anyway. Then it's just like, yeah, just shuffle them. it's good. People trick themselves.
That's amazing. Where did the inspiration come from for this design?
So it's funny, like while designing this, the inspirations I had in mind, I had Dominion, Colorado, and Magic the Gathering. But that's not how it actually started. You know, that's kind of like in the process. I kind of like this idea in games where through your actions, you get to, quote, give the gift of interesting decisions to other players. I like games that do that. And it took me back to many years ago, back at my wife and I would play a game at video stores, this before streaming. So for kids there, you go to a video store and we would go around the store and one person would pick 3 movies and they would present 2 of those movies to the other person while holding one behind their back. Now, you can either pick one of the chosen ones and say, okay, let's watch that. Or if you passed on both of those, the movie we're watching tonight is the one you don't know. And it was kind of like a fun dynamic there where like there's interesting, it was kind of interesting because like how you choose the 3, you know, and which one you choose to hide can be interesting because like you kind of want to pick 3 you like, but what if the one you know they're not going to really agree to, but you really want to watch? You can put that one behind your back. Maybe we'll watch that.
I used to do similar, but I put both behind my back and went right or left hand. Let's go.
Right or left hand. Oh, yeah. So it's similar to that. Yeah, exactly. It's like, or the Monty Hall dilemma where it's like, what's behind door number 3? So, you know, you take that idea and you apply that same decision to cards and you repeat it. And it kind of makes this interesting draft mechanism. So at first I thought of just making a straight set collection game. And you know, put numbers 1 to 9, different colors. And then I thought of a few ways to go, you know, majority score or most of least or, you know, but I kind of wanted something more dynamic. So that's when like Colorado came to mind and, you know, where I really love how it has this, oh, more is generally better until it's not, you know, you want collecting a bunch of cards, but then, oh, when they suddenly start becoming the wrong color, it's actually started counting against you. So that's, you can see like the direct relation to that in the scoring. And that's also, you know, has this wonderful dynamic where the same card can be amazing for me, but awful for you. And it's, you know, it's not just an inherently good or bad card.
I do enjoy that flexibility of cards in games. That's really cool.
Yeah. And then the last thing that came was kind of like the abilities where, you're playing cards here and you're putting them into play. So, you know, being a Magic, you know, Magic fan, I think at that point I was really loving the coming into play effects. And that's kind of like, when you see the cards, like, oh, that's all these are really. It's like, oh, you choose a card and it comes into play and does something. So once it's in play, it's now just a score. But you can see, you know, and that's kind of like the magic element of this.
How did you end up finding its first home with Bard Games as Fickle?
So when the first game started off, I just called it Known Unknown because that's kind of like the choice that started with it. And at that point, I was like, in the game design community, common advice was not to worry about theme. Publishers are going to want to change it anyway. So still having something, even a loose loose theme helps with the play. So a set collection game played with hidden and revealed information. So, okay, known unknown. But then I thought about, well, what are you collecting? You're collecting knowledge. So it became each one of you has to collect an ability and that sense of things or be written spells on old scrolls. So I eventually like changed the name to arcane knowledge, where you're rival wizards sorting through a pile of magic spells, assembling your personal spell book. And it was funny, like how quickly it came together. Being a quick game, it was like easy to get playtests in. So like in under 6 months, I was feeling really good about how it was playing. I made sell sheets and 10 copies of, I just printed out a standard box, deck size box, and was heading to my first Gen Con. And this was 2017. I pitched to several publishers, including actually Kurt Covert, who is, you know, Spirk and Dagger is going to come out with the revision of it. But of course, at the time, I wasn't really good at pitching, and I wasn't able to really express what was special about it. So, you know, I made points about stressing how, you know, it managed to be light, quick game that really thinky and maybe focused too much on the math of it, or, you know, like, oh no, it's a really cool thing that happened. You know, I did not really get to the explanation that captured the fun gotcha moments followed by laughter that what happened to almost every game, you know, like, oh man, you got me. Oh, you know, those sorts of things. I wasn't able to express that part of it at that point. So all the publishers were great. You know, I mean, it was a wonderful experience, but most of them were like, okay, that's interesting. Okay. And very few actually took a copy home. You know, like I was like, oh man, I'm here, try the game. You know, I'll give you a copy, a tester copy here. But one of them that did take a copy home was Brandon at Bard Games. I knew Brandon before as a designer from previous Protospiel events that were local. It's weird that I actually had a meeting in Indiana with him, even though he was kind of local to me. But he and Eric were starting a new game publishing company. He had the copy, and a month after Gen Con, we were at another event, and he came up to me and said, man, we played the heck out of that and loved it. Oh my God, that was so fun. And wanted to see if I was open to a retheme of it. And like, he showed me the art of Amy Brown, which was, you know, what became Fickle. And I said, oh, you want to make the game pretty? Okay, sure. That's great.
You're like, no, I want my game to look ugly.
No, exactly. Oh yeah, that's pretty. Okay, yes. So I signed on and started the retheme process. So while, you know, I think the core in mechanic ideas were already there. I think it really nice thing was going through the retheme where you got the spirit of the game was found then. You know, arcane knowledge had like, it had the interesting decisions, it had the undermining each other's plans. But when you kind of add that, the fairy version of it, the gameplay didn't get any less mean. It was still, it's still a mean game. You're still, you know, sabotaging each other. But then, you know, having these fairies move around between different alliances and in surprising ways that kind of fit the framing of the gameplay, which, you know, kind of earned the title of Fickle. So that's kind of the story about getting from arcane knowledge to Fickle. I could get into a little bit of what happened post Fickle, because it's kind of part of the story.
I mean, it is definitely part of the story, so go for it.
So while it's not really fully my place to tell the Bard Games business story, I just want to say I'm really grateful for working with them. You know, they had a vision, and they were, you know, they really wanted to put out some quality games with beautiful art that thrived at high player counts and didn't really outstay their welcome. So mid 2019, they did a Kickstarter for Fickle that was successful. They're really good. Like they were lined up. They did a quick manufacture and turnaround and delivery to backers. They had games in the queue that were primed, you know, so they'd have a set of games that they were going to promote at conventions in 2020, and then have more games in the queue. So they had the engine going. Unfortunately, 2020 convention season kind of didn't happen. So, you know, they worked to pivot their plans and all that, but you know, switching to online sales and trying to do that, but you know, okay, let's get some more games out to reviewers and maybe get some publicity that way. Made a solo version of the game to play, and I even worked on designing some expansions. A few years later, Bard decided it's time, you know, well, due to the global event and change of plans and everything, it was a good try, but let's shut down. And the rights reverted back to me. It was a good, pleasant conversation. You know, it's like, hey, man, we tried. It was great. I'm very proud of what we did, but it's not, you know, not working right now. But I loved the game, and I was sad that it did not get out actually into proper distribution. So I had the idea of re-implementing a smaller version of it that would get out there and that I'd be able to pitch to other companies. And so that it would live on in some way. So that's when I started going into making Mischief.
So then what were the changes there then?
Well, okay, I'm very proud of Fickle. I mean, it was wonderful. And the reviews that came out were very positive. And even the most critical comments were kind of prefaces. This is a minor complaint, but I listened and appreciated the feedback. So like most of the changes are actually fairly minor, but I did really want to make it. I'm hoping that all of the fun and all the best parts are still there. It's just like a streamlined, more intuitive, and more accessible version. I can get into the development of the process of Fickle, or should I just go straight into like things that changed? This is when I get totally wonky numbers wise, or you know, I could get wonky on the design process that goes way back, or I could just jump from here.
Well, here, why don't we just jump over to, okay, so you've got the game back, you've started working to streamline it, and you at some point get reconnected with Kurt in Smirk and Daggers. So talk about that. How did you end up getting the game re-signed? Why did the name change, the art? And then like, what did you feel like were those streamlining decisions that made the game its best form that is coming out?
It was actually last year at Gamma where we met in person.
Woo!
I met with Kurt. And at this point, I've already done some reworking of it. I was totally fine. I was pitching it as a new game, but acknowledging its history, it is a re-implementation. And this was something that actually Kurt was my like I said, I pitched to him when it was Arcane Knowledge way back many years ago. So it's like he is my ideal for it. And I had a pitch signed up for him. We scheduled a time, and I showed it to him. We played a little bit, and you know, he went through a round and we played a quick game of it, and he's like, okay, can I take this? I'm gonna be going on vacation with my family, and I want to just try this out a little bit more. And I'm like, yes, you can take it right now. It's like, do you have more pitches? That you want to use this for? Is like, Kurt, you are my number one choice. If anyone else wants it, I'm going to, they're going to have to wait till I hear from you. So,
oh, I love that.
It was just great. You know, it's like, it was just a wonderful, like, you know, reaffirming. And he, you know, it was funny. It was, I didn't think about it before, but it was kind of similar. Like, you know, he got back from his trip. We played so much of that. And, you know, same story. It's like, we played the heck out of it. And it was just great, you know, so. Again, like the proof is in the playing. So yeah, so we quickly, you know, came to agreement, you know, like our shared vision of like what it would be, you know, we just talked through and it's like, yeah, we're on the same page. Awesome. Signed the dotted line, and now we're in the re-implementing into Mischief.
Amazing. And so when is Mischief expected to come out? Do you have any idea?
I think he's targeting Gen Con this year, but that's contingent on a few things that I'm not on that side of it.
Oh yeah. I'm sure it has to do with like artwork and like his queue of other games and the manufacturer and Chinese New Year and all that good stuff.
Oh yeah. You just hit all the checks right there. Those are all the factors. It's like you're professional.
I know. It's like, that's what my day job is. Weird.
Exactly. So yeah. I mean like, so what actually changed? Really, there's a couple things. So like some of it are very superficial changes, like just to help with function and flavor, like terminology changes, like families are now tribes, favor is now rank, names now have a keyword as well as a, you know, kind of what the group is called instead of just a single descriptor. The phases were, you know, this is where I kind of named the phases trickery and sabotage instead of just going like just the mechanical process of here's a round. Step one, step two, step three. Then deck composition changed a little bit. Again, like these are really subtle, but can have significant effects. So larger tribes, more tribes per game, and that addressed a couple of issues that, again, like those minor criticisms that I heard before. One complaint was, you know, it's really fun, but you shuffle too many times during the game. You know, you're playing, it's like such a quick game. Why do you have to shuffle so many times? This is where, you know, the design decision at that point was, I'm thinking, well, I kind of liked having the shuffling because then you then have to deal with all the rejected cards coming back. But it ended up being a turnoff for some people to actually have to shuffle. So like, okay, well, let's go with a larger deck. So less mid-game shuffling. And having a larger deck also can increase the player count. So it went from 5 to 6, or, well, really 7, but that would make 2 in-game shuffles instead of 1 at high play counts. More tribes, meaning, so Fickle was played with 5, Mischief is 6. So that kind of makes the scoring a little less punishing, and the arc of the play changes a little bit. Because in again, like, it was a deliberate design decision in Fickle where the first 3 rounds were kind of like you're building your alliance, and then the last 2 is like, oh my god, it's either falling apart or I'm just trying to mitigate the losses. Whereas kind of increasing the number, even like I said, by 1 tribe, it kind of pushes that cut a little bit later. So like, it's really like the last round where it's like, oh yeah, that's the most agonizing round, the big drama at the end, rather than having this arc of building and then falling apart. So other than that, let's see, another comment was, you know, why only 5 abilities in a game? Why, I'd want a little bit more in each game. Other things, player count was in Fickle, it was posted as 3 to 5 players. And again, that was a decision that we kind of came to, because the 2-player version kind of does feel a little bit different. It totally works, but instead of being like this raucous, you know, like, aha, blah, 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 it's very tense, where you're like, I know that you know that I know you know, you know, the Princess Bride puzzle, you know. And it really, and it works best when 2 people are equally skilled at it. You know, when one person knows what they're doing and the other one doesn't, it's a slaughter every time. So that's why we kind of did not put 2-player in Fickle. But now in this one, we're going to go include, and also the solo mode now exists. So just saying 1 to 6 works. And we'll just put a note in there that, yes, 2-player is great. It just feels different, you know, and here's recommendations on how to do that. Other things, there's fewer tribes in Mischief. So Fickle had 22 in the base game, and I worked on 2 expansions that, you know, were unpublished. So I had like, I have 48 tribes that, you know,
wow,
could possibly be played.
Fairy army.
Yeah, exactly. And because I was just having fun, because it's a fun system. It really is. Like, it's just a joy every time it gets played. Like, you know, anyway, I digress. But no, we streamlined down to 13 that are kind of easy interactions and more stable when using like random combinations of them. One of the things in Fickle was, you know, I had some more advanced effects that you could use that people who got into it really loved, but people who are more casual just kind of like were confused by. And those were basically like delayed effects and instant effects that you can kind of react to what somebody is doing. And that, like, not an issue for Magic players, but for a casual gamer, it was like, what? You mean I can interrupt what somebody's doing? You know, and I have to, the timing on that, and that's tricky stuff for, you know, more casual players. And it's like, it makes more sense to just separate that all that off, and just like, if this is successful, cross my fingers, we can always do expansions of stuff later. I got plenty to work with.
Yeah, it sounds like you have plenty of content, but that does sound like that was the right move to like streamline it and make it more accessible to new players, especially since I'm guessing Kurt is trying to move more into mass market, especially after like Boop's success. And this sounds like a game that'll do really well there from the changes you've made.
Yeah, we're hoping, you know, like, you know, simplified interactions, and it, hopefully it's not too complex for even more casual gamers. And then another, you know, then the other thing is the art. So there's going to be new art created by an artist, Nen Cheng. She's got a really cool, distinct style, and it's a little darker. One of the things with Fickle, like, it, again, I love it. It's beautiful. But almost verbatim, like almost every review was like, I didn't think this game was going to be for me. It looked like a sweet fairy game. And then I didn't, then I started playing it. Like, oh my God, we're backstabbing each other. Oh, I love this. You know, so it was like,
wasn't edgy enough.
It was not edgy enough. So now the artwork is actually kind of going to help set that mindset ahead of time, as opposed to, oh, this is sweet. Let's play it with our kids. This is a nice, no, it's not a nice game. It is a very, you know, again, sabotage and trickery. You know, that's the name of the game.
It's going to leave you smirking with your dagger.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's like, you know, Kurt is, you know, smirking dagger. It's a perfect place for this. I feel in my heart. But it's, you know, like I said, all these things, all these changes, like, are fairly subtle, but, you know, it's amazing. You know, as you know, a designer yourself, you know, like, the slightest change, like one number switch, can have significant repercussions. So I'm hoping all these little switches will be in the right direction to get it out there and be more accessible.
That's great. I look forward to seeing this newer, streamlined, edgy-ish version of it. So how long, I always ask this question of how long in total did it take from that inspiration to publication, but since it'll have its second life, I guess, how long was the initial inspiration to the publication of Fickle? We'll go with that.
Okay, so yeah, so like, it was probably the end of 2016. Like I said, it was a fairly rapid development to the point where I was happy with it mechanically. Signed it and then rethemed, spent like a year retheming and retuning. Yeah, so it was under 3 years from the time the first idea came to my head, my notebook, to I'm pulling the shrink wrap off of a printed copy. So it was under 3 years.
Okay. So yeah, so pretty standard. And then now you got the new one coming.
Right.
I look forward to seeing it hopefully at Gen Con then. So for the experience between both games and the design process, what was your favorite and your least favorite moment of that journey?
Man, so many highs with it. You know, there's like...
Attempt to choose one. One-ish.
Yeah, I know. I mean, since it was my first game, I'd say, like, you know, the actual having like that production copy in front of me, like that was pretty amazing. You know, like, oh my God, this is it. You know, that moment where it becomes real, I guess, was just an amazing moment, and then I could actually share it. You know, it's no longer just this idea, this crazy idea that might happen someday. It's for real. It's here in front of me.
Yeah. It's like validating, because it's like you say you're a designer, you go to these design groups, but then like actually having a physical product to show for it, it like really does change something inside you. So I get what you mean.
Yeah. And then the difficult one was, I would say when we made something we were very proud of, like everyone involved was very proud of, but then it kind of fizzles after the fact, you know, like during COVID, where like, oh yeah, this is not going to make it. No distribution for this, and there's no publicity. You know, it's like they're, you know, you got a first time designer, first time publisher. It's like no one's really going to pay attention to this. So it was a valiant effort. We joke like, yeah, it took a global event to stop them, because I think Bard, like I said, I believe in what they were doing. I think they could have been really, it could have gone great, because they really had that machine ready to go. They had a vision of like the kind of games they wanted to make, and it's very sad to see like that not happen, because it was really like, I love that window of games where it's like it's a quick game and it's a fun game for a large group, and while still being for gamers, and you kind of mix, and you can mix that gamer with the casual, you know, and it's still fun. I'm sad to see Bard close.
Yeah, it sounded like they did have a good setup. I know a lot of companies that had the whole convention circuit down, and it really took a lot of adjusting to get the digital stuff going. And it's a bummer how many companies either disappeared or had to merge or just like went through a lot of like staffing changes. And I mean, we're still kind of seeing that, honestly. It sounds like it found a good new home, though.
Yeah.
And a second life.
Yeah, exactly. I love it.
Well, here, I always ask if you could give a piece of advice to designers, but I want you to gear it towards like kind of having your first game, seeing what people were saying, and then like the changes you made to make the second version. Like, try to gear your advice towards that. Like, how to make the best version of what you started with.
Well, it's funny. Like, that's not too different from what I would just give advice to anyone who wants to design. I think finding your community is really important. Finding your local game groups, game design groups. And if you don't mind, could I talk a little bit about the local design community here? Or?
Heck yeah, go for it.
Okay. So something that happened last year, the SF Bay Area actually is thriving with a lot of board game design. We had many, many, many meetups around the Bay Area. And, you know, we're all kind of members of each other's groups. In a way. So we kind of like kept running into each other. We all see each other at conventions and then, you know, break off to our local one-off meetups. So last year we decided to actually come together and kind of make an umbrella, like single identity for all of the groups that we just kind of merged, you know, Voltroned into what is now we're calling the Golden Gate Game Makers. So we got like a dozen different groups that just kind of came together and like, no, we're all now going to share a single Discord and a single Facebook and a single, you know, meetup site and with meetings all around the Bay Area. And so we're like encouraging everyone just like, hey, come on. We just have a shared vision of like, no, we want this to be fun. And our code of conduct is, while explicitly stated out, can be summed up with don't be a jerk. And yeah, come on, come in. Everyone, it doesn't matter. We have very successful professional designers. We have students. We have first-time people all kind of coming together and just kind of we're in it for the fun. And like, everyone's welcome. Please, please come in. You know, again, that's my plug for Golden Gate Game Makers, really.
I love the plug.
Anyone in the Bay Area, please look us up and come to any meetup.
Ooh, I might come harass you at some point. My brother actually lives in San Francisco, so I do go to the area pretty frequently. Actually, I think I'm going to be there in a week for a layover.
Oh, give me a call.
Yeah, if it's a long layover, maybe I will. Well, here, I want to know, like, what inspires your design process? Are you a theme person, mechanic person? Like, what would you say is, like, your core inspiration for your designs?
Oh, that's hard to say, because, like, it can go either way. I mean, sometimes I just go... I try to look for something fun. I've got one that was inspired by my kids going the wrong way on an escalator, playing that game. So I have like a tile sliding. It's a tile sliding game where you're playing on the tiles as they slide. Some are just like I said, this one was started with a game that my wife and I used to play in the video store. One of the core things I want in all my games is I want actual interaction between people, you know, and that's really, I'm looking for that. What that interaction is.
Totally makes sense. And do you have any other projects that are coming out in the future that you want people to know about?
I need to get better at pitching. So I got developed like a dozen games. I need to get out there more. I have a couple that are with publishers being assessed right now, but nothing that is definitely coming other than Mischief at this point.
Hey, that's not a bad place to be. And you, I mean, on the podcast, you're sounding good and like you can pitch. So clearly you're getting better.
Yes. Not going to go like, well, you know, the math on this is really not interesting in that.
Yeah. You already made me fall asleep. No offense.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't go there. You know, focus on the fun of it.
Totally agree. Well, then here for my last question, if you could have been the designer of a game you didn't design, what game would you want it to be?
I guess the easy cheats would be like either Magic or Dominion, since they kind of were the things that kind of got me hooked into this. But actually, I'm going to go with a recent revelation. Like, I think I'm a big fan of Phil Walker Harding for what my design style matches with. You know, takes like an idea and then kind of streamlines it down to like, oh man, that's core. It's interesting. And it's just smooth, you know? So I'm going to go with, I'll say Gizmos is a recent one that I just started playing. I was like, oh man, why have I not been playing this? This is awesome.
See, that's one that's on my list to play because I'm also a huge fan of Phil's designs. And I got to meet him in person last year. And it was funny because he twice during the same convention was looking at one of my games. And he's like, I have a very similar game that I'm working on. And he like showed me it. And I was like, huh, our brains think similar. This is like very validating. I know. It was like good moment for me. This is awesome.
Yeah. And that's another thing about finding your community is like you have those moments a lot where you're like, oh, wow, you get to see people who think differently and also people who think the same. And you like, you know how to bounce ideas off of each other. It's just like, oh, that makes so much of this so much fun.
Yeah, I will say that is one thing I feel that I'm very much lacking in my current location of where I live, because everyone is like, I either have to drive 2.5 hours to New York City or like 1.5 hours to Boston if I want to be around other designers in person, which is a bummer because I used to have like 1 or 2 meetups I went to every week in the Chicago area. Like I was a fiend at playtesting in person. And now I just kind of make a lot of friends at my rock climbing gym and give them pizza to come over to my place and playtest. I use bribery and I'm unashamed.
Well, you know, I mean, I think you could also just inspire some of them to start designing. It's like, this is fun. Come join me. Come to the dark side.
Oh gosh, no, some of them do enjoy the fact that they're like, oh my god, my name is on this game, because they get playtest credits or they get to like have an opinion on how something changes. That is very nice, honestly, as a playtester, that you like gave a suggestion that actually makes it into the final game. So they get more than just pizza. They get validation and friendship and all that good stuff.
Well, that's how it all starts, you know. You see that slight change you made, and now you're like, what if I were to take a game and take a different twist on it?
Uh-huh. Exactly. That's how you catch the bug.
Yeah.
I appreciate you being on the show. And everyone who's been listening, thanks for joining us for this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 84, Mischief. And again, thanks, Glenn, for being on the show. If anyone's trying to find you, where can you be found online so they can follow you?
I should be more online, but let's see. I guess on the Twitter X, whatever it is now, Headcrafted Pix, P-I-X. I have a site that it's not a very professional site. I just dump ideas up there just to kind of track some of the games I'm working on. I have headcraftedgames.com. That's probably good if anyone is interested in the games. Oh yeah, last thing. GoldenGateGameMakers.com. Go there, join our Discord, and you know, and get into the online part of that too.
And I'm guessing you're probably open to like just playtesters too, not just designers.
Oh, absolutely. No, the whole idea behind Golden Gate Game Makers is anyone who has even a vague interest. It's actually kind of nice. You know, we actually honor our playtesters. Like, you're our heroes. You're coming in. You don't even have a game. You just want to play. It's more than welcome. And anyone who's even curious, we encourage people, if you just have an idea and you just want to, you know, bounce it off some people, that's great too. As inclusive as you can possibly be.
Well, then definitely people check that out. And I'm your host of this podcast, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me online, you can find me on social media, such as like Instagram, X, Blue Sky, under Token Gamer, and that's G-A-Y-M-E-R. I also have a website. It's dmrcreativegroup.com. It also has like my games that I've designed or that I'm working on and all that good stuff. And I should probably plug it more. So thanks for reminding me, Glenn.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for being on.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or gaming table, check out AllPlay at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.